Welcome to The Weekly. I'm Jeremy.
I'm Chris.
And this week on The Weekly, G4 teams with Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Warhammer animation preview.
Ooh.
And the Frosthaven designer makes some changes.
Ooh, nice.
All right. So, do you remember G4? Gamer television? I didn't even think that was still a thing. But they just made an announcement that they're partnering with Dungeons & Dragons to expand the scope of how gaming culture has evolved. There's so much horrible corporate speak in this.
Expand what?
So they're partnering with Wizards of the Coast, and they're going to broadcast their D&D Live 2021, which is like as an annual event where they update their kind of campaign storyline. Yeah, and what are they bringing to the table besides cameras? Well, they're bringing the comedy and the, I don't know, commentary. I don't know. I mean, they are a gamer TV, but that meant video games, you know?
I don't know. I've said this before, I watch live streamed games or actual plays mostly to learn how to play a system.
Right.
And it can't be like a super dry kind of just playing the game mechanically. Like, I do want to hear people play, but if it's too much to the mechanical stuff or too much to the, we're just going to banter and bullshit for 2 hours, like, I don't want that. Like, learn how to play. I kind of don't get the critical role stuff, or I don't get the, we're going to play this game live in front of an audience. I kind of don't get that, though I realize it is a form of entertainment. And if that's what you like, then okay, go for it. Linking that back to the G4 thing, what are they going to comment on? Right? Like, it's not like an esports game or like a sports game where you're going to kind of do rundown analysis or whatever, you know? Like, especially if all they're going to get is like the campaign update stuff. For those of you who don't know, Forgotten Realms is the default D&D. Like, is that what they're going to do with commentary? I don't know.
I have no idea. And kind of nerd, especially tabletop humor, really gets cringy. Oh, yeah. Elves. Am I right?
No, you're not, because nerd humor sucks.
So it's going to be brutal. But I guess they're trying to kind of pivot into, you know, broadening their audience. And they're also saying, you know, we have the ability to make this, you know, to bring more people to the table, to make this much more open, to let people know what tabletop is about. And like,
You do. I think the only reason they're doing this is because they lost Critical Role.
Oh, they did.
Well, I mean, they never really had it. Mm-hmm. That was Geek and Sundry. Mm-hmm. But this has got to be something. You know, I mean, they're still partnered with them, and they're still playing D&D 5e, I think. But, you know, Critical Role being its own company, WotC probably said, we need something a little bit more controllable.
I see.
I guess. That's my theory.
Yeah, I still remember there were, like, ESPN rumblings of, like, you know, when they were doing StarCraft, you know, they were showing StarCraft tournaments on, like, ESPN 4 or whatever. I remember rumblings of, like, yeah, we're going to try to figure out how to do tabletop and make that a competitive sport. And I haven't heard anything since.
Well, I kind of get that. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't, esports is sports the way bowling is a sport, right? Like, you just kind of sit in your chair and do stuff. But I do recognize it's become popular enough to, you know, kind of get that kind of attention.
Right.
And I've been thinking about some TTRPGs, I think, are designed for, tournament or what I'm calling society play, where the rules have to be written in such a way that you can show up to a, like, a Pathfinder Society, whatever game, on Friday night, completely new GM, completely different players you've never played before, and expect a reasonably even experience from week to week to week to week, right? Like, outliers aside with random personalities, the rules have to be written with very or minimal interpretation so that you get that consistent thing. That does kind of lend itself to an esports style running of a game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you could do it.
Right.
Would I want to watch it? No. Would anyone else want to watch it? Who knows? But, like, you could do it, and okay, if you do it that way, I could see, like, commentary people. Like, y'all just play the game. We'll have little side commentary back here about what spell they just used or why they kind of went for this attack or why they kind of did that. It would be boring as all fuck. But you could do it, right?
Right, yeah. right, right. Yeah, so it's interesting. And G4 is saying that they will help elevate and amplify the tabletop experience. And I think that's they're putting themselves a little bit ahead of, I think, their position in popular culture. But and accessibility is something that they keep talking about. So, and with us focusing... their core competencies. I love this corporate speak. Their core competencies are comedy and entertainment, okay. And with focusing us there and D&D bringing their juice for the hardcore fan base, you now have a mixture that is wildly entertaining and also super serves the tabletop community.
That's it.
Super serves the table. This is just so it's a combination of like all these corporate buzzwords and then like goofy, like totally amazing dude. Yeah,
I kind of
it's gonna
back up on that, whatever they say, gamer juice in there.
Yeah, like, oh, no. The juice and it's super serve. Like, oh, no. Yeah, but we'll see. But so this may open the door to other things. So they've also said, you know, if this goes well, that G4 may consider events like a Pokemon World Championships or Warhammer Live.
Those are, but again, fandoms. Like Warhammer Live is kind of like that state of the whatever WotC thing where it's not content, right?
Right.
But it's just a presentation of what's coming up.
Right.
And how, I'm sure it's like new model releases or where the meta story is going or all that stuff, even if that's even a word, meta story. Mm-hmm. But what do you comment on about that?
Yeah.
Or unless you do like post show analysis, right?
Yeah, right.
Which is the extent of my sports knowledge, right? But like, what are you going to do? Like, talk about.
I'm surprised they're bringing out elves before dwarves.
Yeah, really. Like, is that what they're going to do? Or talk about it from like the character's perspective or whatever?
And there's already such a level of kind of commentary and community that goes on Twitch and YouTube and Twitter, you know, so it's going to be hard to even compete with that. So G4 is still a cable network, or are they like an online?
No idea.
Yeah. So I only knew them as a cable network. So if they are not that... I mean, they just don't have the reach or the influence, and there's so many people that are going to be doing it so much better. And because there's a lot of YouTubers that just watch these live things and comment while they're watching them. So how are you going to compete with that? Someone you've got like a parasocial relationship with because you've watched all their YouTube, and then you're going to switch
again, over the to only G4. Thing I can think of that maybe is why WotC would be doing this is control.
Yes.
Like if fan people do all this commentary stuff, WotC has no control over what they actually say. I mean, unless they want to issue like DCMAs or whatever. Or takedown stuff. If they're partnering with G4, not, who knows, maybe they'll actually give them a script beforehand.
Yeah,
or they can say, true. Like, this is the stuff you can say, this is the stuff you can't say, blah, 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 and they just have more corporate control of what's going on.
Yeah, and it'll be just a more positive, positive message out there, because people won't be disappointed or like, what
be
are
like,
you
whoa, this fucking sucks, and be like, everything would be awesome.
Right. Yeah, so we'll find out, because D&D Live is going to broadcast July 16th and 17th on the D&D Twitch channel. Oh, and G4 streaming networks. So I guess they are just a streaming network now. Okay. So how? I don't even know. I mean,
maybe it's just more eyeballs.
Yeah, I guess. But that doesn't make any sense, because there's already so many places to see this experience.
That's true. But maybe WotC is just like, how much is it going to cost to put on the air? Ah, fine, whatever.
Yeah. No, it's true. And it may just, you know, if they become like an official outlet, then, you know, advertising, they can monetize the heck out of it with advertising. So we will see. So we made a brief mention of Warhammer Live, and Games Workshop has announced they're going to do a live event this weekend, and it is a preview stream. So this Saturday, whichever day that would be, the 22nd of May, they will be doing a preview of their animation. So
they've been teasing
the heck out of this, and they give no details. We kind of know from bits and pieces and trailers and things that they've been doing what projects are underway. This will be the best look yet at the kind of state of all these different animation projects. So it's several different studios, or actually sometimes just individuals working on things. And we're going to get animation in both the 40K and Age of Sigmar settings. Of course, there's no details whatsoever about what we're going to look at. And they've been kind of doing that lately. Things are real close to the chest. They're not sharing as much and kind of getting people excited about things. They're just waiting for these kind of events. And maybe because, you know, their physical events, their in-person events have died. So they've tried to turn this into something that why you would go to that show. So why you would tune in.
Again, it kind of seems like control.
Yeah, yeah, I think
leak stuff too far in advance, or not leak stuff, even release stuff too far in advance, and give people a chance to talk about it. And if people aren't happy,
it's interesting though, because these are, you know, little independent groups of animators. They must have signed some real ironclad NDAs, sure, you know, to work on this, because you'd think storyboards and character designs would be leaking everywhere. And so, you know, but that would get people excited. They don't see that as a good thing. So they're just kind of choking this. And then like, here's the official release, official preview. And some of it, it makes me feel a little, there's a, let me see, a Iron Warriors CGI feature called the Iron Within, which is kind of anime styled. I don't think we really need that. And I think the maker of Hell's Reach is doing the Blood Angels, Blood Angels, Angels of Death series. So two, those are the two things that they named in the release. And also the second season, which we got a little bit of like in flashes, a little tease of the second season of Astartes. And that's like animated by one person. Right. So that's amazing. The funny thing is, I think they were kind of making up their own lore. They were kind of like world building within that. So the things we saw, we may, they may, Games Workshop make them pull back and say, yeah, we're not going to, no, you can't use this, you can't do that. Because there was some really compelling, like really what is going on here that, you know, felt 40K, but also kind of pushed you into this really, you know, kind of crazy world. But yeah, so that's one person. So, you know, and this is animation too. So that's the other thing Games Workshop may not quite understand, is like the production times of animation. You get one passionate person working on a fan project, they're going to work on it differently than when you're setting these goals, you know, to reach. And yeah, then you get this check, and then you do this, and you get another check, you know. So who knows? And so some of the passion may be squeezed out of stuff. So we will see. So that happens, this weekend, the 22nd, on Twitch, I think, their official Twitch channel. So we'll see what the state of things are. And it feels very much like an animation festival, just like kind of random styles and random storytelling, you know, levels of storytelling. So you're like, okay, it's not going to be cohesive. It's not going to be, and I'm worried that the announcement is going to be, and these are all pay-per-view. You can pay, you know, $9.99 per episode to watch them. Like, they're going to, they have to figure out how to, you know, sell
do
this.
It. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I forgot they have to figure out a way how to sell it.
Yeah.
But last week, the 14th, the Netflix original anthology Love, Death, and Robots 2 came out.
I haven't had enough of that.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't had enough of that. Like, and like, I was, I felt compelled to watch it only because I had bagged on one.
Right, right.
But like, even though I didn't like at least like half of the episodes or like the little bits in part one, I think that's like, I liked the concept and the idea. Here's 16 completely different, like 10 to 15 minute shorts.
Right. Presented in random order per viewer. Are they still doing that?
No, no, no. Like, well, but by the time I watched Love, Death, and Robots 1, like all 16 or 15 of them were out. Mm. And I think the order that they presented them in Japanese Netflix was different from what they did elsewhere.
Oh, yeah. I heard it was like randomly per viewer. Like you start watching it it just like randomly.
I didn't know that. Maybe by the time I hit it, I was just like, I could go, okay, next episode, next episode, next episode. Right. But like, even though I didn't like them, it kind of reminded me of like maybe like MTV's like Liquid Television a little bit, where it's like, this is just kind of experimental and people can kind of do whatever they want. And some of the styles and were like awesome. Some of the stories were awesome, even if they didn't always like pair together really well between the two things. I'm like, yeah, fine. Like, I think that's how they would, GW would hopefully have to do it. Like, just like, here's an anthology.
Right.
Because to me, anthology says it's not going to be a cohesive story. Here's just five, six, seven, whatever little bits, and they're all going to be different and hopefully you like them.
Yeah.
Or you like them enough.
And there's got to be like one that's so good at like Astartes is going to carry this whole thing. People are going to, if there's a paywall or something, they're going to pay and then they get, you get all this content, but I'm only paying for Astartes. Yeah.
Yeah. That's a really good point. I think the one that they advertised for Love, Death, and Robots was that like Battle Beast thing. Like, anyway, that was, no, the worst of them. But yeah, you're right. They'd have to do like, here's the one you are most excited to see or that most people are really going to like.
Right.
And not to say that the others are going to suck, but yeah, one has to like carry it so that people decide to pay for it.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's GW prices, woof, Astartes better be good.
I know. Yeah, I don't know what they're going to do. They're going to go about it pretty greedily, and it's going to, of course, then be different prices in different regions and stuff. And they're going to have to Well, I don't know. They're kind of backing away from that, but do some multilingual support. So there's at least subtitles for every
region.
Yeah,
there's going to have to be subtitles. Yeah.
So I don't know. We'll see. It's going to be a real mixed bag. And I don't know. I mean, I guess because there was just so much great fan stuff being produced, they wanted to get a handle on it before it got out of control.
Why would you not?
And before, like, you know, a studio got so influential that, like, fans of that fan film were like, why isn't this in your lore? They can get their arms around this and prevent that sort of thing from happening.
I wonder if that would happen. Because, I mean, GW has some, like, rabidly loyal fans where they're like, why isn't this in your lore? And it's like, because we make the lore. Right. You're free to stop playing and buying your miniatures. Right. You know you won't.
Yeah, so we'll see what this looks like. I don't know. I don't know. I'm not excited about it, and I'm terrified about how what you're going to have to do to be able to watch these. So I don't know. Because they're not going to – they won't be for free. They're not going to be on a YouTube channel or anything. They're going to figure out a way – because that was the real disappointing thing. Mystery Science Theater had a big Kickstarter recently for their whatever season of the show. It was the show that was on Netflix. Like, Netflix originally screened it, and they did a Kickstarter for that. They raised like millions and millions, like 12 million, some ridiculous amount of money for that season. It wasn't very good. And now they're doing it again, getting you to raise more money for very weak episodes, and they're putting it behind this paywall, like kind of streaming, like in a small, probably like VOD kind of service. It's like,
So if you back the Kickstarter,
You get access to that, and otherwise you pay a monthly, to have access to it. I don't know. I don't know that that felt – you already kind of failed, didn't do a great job. Netflix doesn't want to have anything to do with anymore. Okay. Yeah, they just kind of, license and it's gone.
Right.
And never got international release. It never showed up on any others.
Sorry. Like, it doesn't sound all that great, but it's similar to – Kickstarters for TTRPG stuff, where it's like, okay, we're going to kickstart this book or this game, whatever. If you missed it, here's the backer kit.
Right.
Or it's been not even a significant amount of time sometime, but it was like as long as we want. PDF is available on DriveThruRPG or Itch, or you can buy the physical copies here. And is that, it's the same exact thing. Mm-hmm. I don't feel as bad about that as I do. No, actually, I don't really care about the Mystery Science thing. But all I'm saying is, it's the same model, right?
Yeah,
it's the same model. Yeah,
I don't know. I just don't. I don't know what they're doing, and they're getting funding for this, and we should all just be happy and be able to participate and enjoy this, and not pay another subscription. It's really weird, and so that's what I'm worried. Games Workshop is going to have us another. Oh, but it's only $4 a month or whatever and they're going to staggered release schedule. It's like another thing that
streaming is kind of getting ridiculous. It's like the Wild West of streaming, and I think companies, getting a bit on a tangent here, I think companies are overestimating how loyal customers will be to watch certain shows. They're like, oh, I'm going to buy like Peacock streaming to watch this, or let's watch this. It's like, you know what, I'm at the point where I'm like, I got Japanese Netflix. If it ain't on Japanese Netflix, I ain't watching it, and I don't care. If I super care, I'll pirate the damn thing.
Right. So. Yeah, this is just our breaking into shows. It's like, this is the American Office streaming service. This is the Simpsons streaming service, where you just pay for a specific show to have access to it all the time. Yeah, who knows? But speaking of Kickstarters, and how about wildly successful Kickstarters? Frosthaven was in the news recently, and the designer was addressing harmful tropes and was talking about decolonizing its design and talking cultural consultancy. So this came up, and anybody that's been in the comment section of a Kickstarter, people are
been in the comment section period
of anything. So it can get pretty vicious. People are like going after your manufacturing, your sources, or then something gets popular enough, they're like, okay, so is this the same world? Well, I've got a few problems with what you established. So if you can't see this gigantic box, it's going to tip over the table. So this is Gloomhaven, the first version, and insanely popular. I have the number. Somewhere, the third largest project overall when it came out. $13 million for a board game. But what a board game. It's a monster. And it simulates...
That's a brick game.
It simulates, dungeon crawling and the RPG experience really well. Cooperative dungeon crawling with an original setting. So this is like original... cultures and types of creatures and races. And so that's the thing that came up, and Isaac Childress, the designer, who any contact or any interaction or anything I've read that in his interviews and everything, is just a really nice, amazing guy. So you don't feel bad at all about his success. Like, okay. It feels very deserved. He's worked really hard. And I think there's a couple of things we can talk about with this, but sure. I think this is a symptom of his success as well. So once something gets to be large enough, you know, a lot of eyes are mm-hmm. on you. So so released a statement in the updates talking about the title was Getting Narrative Right. And in it, he explains the efforts that they've had to tackle the inherent problems in Frosthaven, an extension of Gloomhaven. So Frosthaven was a standalone expansion to this game, kind of the icy right. version, you know, icy setting of this game. And so by extension, Gloomhaven, the storytelling and world building, namely a lack of choice and bog standard fantasy tropes, unintentionally left players in the cold.
Okay.
So the one thing that they focus on is in the fantasy setting, the kind of human culture is a colonizer.
Right.
And your characters, kind of without a choice, get involved in that culture. Like, you're participating in that. And a big thing that they are trying to do with that narrative is kind of make it a background. They don't want to change that element of the world, because that's kind of this thing you're opposing, or you can oppose, or whatever. But kind of backgrounding it so that you're not aiding this right. this or culture that you may be offended by.
Yeah, at least to give you a choice.
Right, right. And to make it, yeah. And so, and there was an interesting quote overall about race. So that's the thing that I think people were sensitive about. And so by using the term race, this is a quote from Childress, I'm not only reinforcing this outdated way of delineating people, but I'm also reinforcing the idea that those delineations are so extreme that the difference between a black person and a white person is as great as the difference between a squishy human and a pile of rocks. So kind of moving towards culture, talking about cultures right. instead of race, because of how useless race ends up being, and especially in these fantasy terms. Mm-hmm. And then when you start to make, you know, kind of direct comparisons right. To real world races. So the point is, I need to fix them, not only to stop real world harm for players who may react negatively to such depictions, but also to make the world building stronger and more carefully thought out for all players to enjoy.
Yeah.
And so to these ends, they have hired a cultural consultant. So this is James Mendez Hodes. And this person has also worked with several like recognizable projects. So Monster mm-hmm. Hearts, Jiangxi, the Blood in the Banquet Hall, and working with Magpie Games on their Avatar, the Last Airbender RPG, which is full of all kinds of...
I know Alan's excited for it.
Yeah.
Right, sorry, not to toss Alan on the bus.
But just talking about the cultural landmines, I think that whole thing is just like...
you know what? Losing my nerd cred here, but I don't fucking care about it. I've never watched Avatar.
Good. I think that's the best.
I've also never watched Legend of Korra, which supposedly is better. And I've not watched...
You've only seen the M. Night Shyamalan movie.
Nope, haven't even seen that either. But I know that's like the worst of all of them, because we're just like, let's recast everything as white people. And you're like, yeah. But no, like, I've been in TTRPG and just kind of like pop culture nerd circles enough mm-hmm. to have gotten kind of the problems with Avatar and the whole kind of mm-hmm. series. So, and I was aware of what was going on with Frosthaven, even if I didn't really know about Frosthaven all that much.
Yeah, so, I mean, it sounds all around positive, and I trust Isaac Childress. I trust his decision-making. Mm. He's done a very interesting, great job of world building so far, and the fact that he wants to be as inclusive as right. possible and to kind of take down any barriers. So my question's kind of about this sort of situation is there's a couple of things. So we've talked about cultural consultancies or sensitivity editors
right.
in RPGs, and that it is a good thing. Like basically, like my knee-jerk reaction is just, yes, this is a good thing. The thing, though, especially in this case, that I'm thinking about is similar to when a company grows to a certain mm-hmm. size, the lawsuits begin.
Okay.
And you have to defend, you know, your intellectual properties or trademarks or whatever, because there's a lot of people that see you as a big target. So this is the second like multi-million-dollar Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. And so it's got a big audience. And so now, you know, it's come to the attention of people that want to make sure that, you know, that want to, you know, get rid of some of those old fantasy tropes. If you are creating this whole new world, why are you bringing that baggage with you?
Right.
the problem is a couple of things that kind of raises the price tag of producing anything. Mm-hmm. So now that's going to be an added expense from now on. And doesn't that, especially because there are so many small indie projects that can't afford to be able to do that, and so it's pushing the cost of producing board games or RPGs up, and is going to leave some people behind, where they're just going to have to basically crowdsource the sensitivities. So basically, we can't afford to do this, but everyone that's backing this project, please take a look and give us some feedback. And because that's what a lot of people do with translation,
right? Okay,
you know, kind of proofreading for translations and stuff. So it's going to kind of raise that bar and make it more expensive. And the other thing that I was thinking is, you know, based on who you're hiring for this, like whose sensitivity is it? And I think that the idea is you're future proofing this and trying to make it not something that is people are going to say, oh yeah, wow, when was this made?
Right.
I don't feel comfortable playing this. And so, but you're still dealing with like it, whoever that editor is or whoever the consultant is, it's going to be kind of their view or kind of what they're seeing as the current, you know, the current difficulties,
sure,
like what needs to be worked out. So
I guess that last part, mm-hmm, do you ever think that's avoidable? Like I get trying to like future proof stuff,
right?
But
right. Yeah, it's
times are going to change.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
like, even if you like, I agree with you, cultural sensitivity reading and just kind of sensitivity reading in general is a positive, but things are always going to be a time capsule.
Mm-hmm.
And excuse me, I think the best you can do with regards to kind of sensitivity reading is saying, currently, this is what's going on and where we are. Let's at least make sure the game is up to these current standards, rather than kind of being a relic of the past once it already kind of gets to people's hands.
Yeah.
I kind of think that's the best you can do. Or maybe a little bit you can kind of, like, you can't predict the future, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm not going to say like a little bit. You know, so it's just like, nope, it's kind of up to standards.
Right, right.
Or at least current trends, right, is kind of the best you can do.
Yeah, and it's just the kind of coincidence of this not being brought up during the success of the first game, it coming up now. Also, there's something a little distasteful in kind of this call-out culture kind of thing that's going on. It's like, so this issue was brought up.
Mm-hmm.
The designer, creator addressed it. But did he have a choice? Because if he's like, okay, I know this is, it's not perfect. It's my weird version of the world. It's got all my biases, all my weird prejudices in there. That's what created the world. If he doesn't address it, now this is an alt-right, Nazi sympathetic franchise.
I'm not going to go that far. Like, okay, I see what you're saying. And I don't know what happened around Frosthaven.
Mm-hmm.
It sounds like the creator did this on their own.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
They kind of said...
They're, I think, responding to comments, yeah.
Or, well, that's what I mean. Like, I don't know if there were enough comments where the creator had to respond to it, or if the creator just had kind of grown and said, you know what?
Mm.
Let's improve this. You know, like, I think that's kind of the ethical way.
Right.
It's just like, oh, look at the state of the world. Then look at your game and you're like, nah, stuff's not really sitting right with me anymore. Mm-hmm. I have the ability to change it, so let's do it.
Yeah.
It kind of sounds like that was the latter. But I guess in terms of like larger call-out stuff, I don't think, I mean, like cancel culture is going out of control, right? But I don't think cancel culture has as large an effect as some people make it out to be. Right? Like if Frosthaven had been changed in response to a massive kind of campaign, right? Like the author would not have had to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The consequence could have possibly been Frosthaven isn't successful.
Right.
Or doesn't get kickstarted. Right. So, I mean, like you always have a choice, but I don't think in general that the cancel culture army has as much power as people make it out to be, right?
Right. Yeah.
It's just like things end up being like an echo chamber, so people may seem loud, but I mean, I don't go on Kickstarter for board games all that much, but every once in a while, stuff that's pretty culturally insensitive will come up on my feed where people kind of shit around and they're like, look at this, and it's already Kickstarted. So I feel, and this is my bias, and maybe I'm going the other way, right? The rate at which games that are culturally kind of insensitive get Kickstarted or are successful are informing that decision on mine, where I'm like, no, we tell you what side I'm on, right? We don't have the amount of power you think we do, because if we did, games like this would not have been made or would not have been successfully Kickstarted. Mm-hmm. And I tend to think, no evidence to support this, but I tend to think that, yeah, the number of games that do get successfully Kickstarted and made, lost my train of thought. Well, you know what I'm trying to say.
I think
are kind of anecdotal evidence that cancel culture doesn't have as much power as people
right.
say it does.
Yeah, and I think it's just the you know erring on the side of protecting the IP, protecting the everything you've invested, because you don't want the chance that someone's going to retweet it, something right. About this game that is then going to create this ripple effect. And you never know, because those things, like, really, it's really weird, like alignment of stars and stuff that, like, things start to cascade. It's like, wow, we don't like that anymore. Okay. It's like,
I'm going to say that's a cynical approach or the cynical version.
It is.
Like, it certainly is something people have to think about, but I'm going to say, like, the altruistic version is kind of what I said before, where the author or the creator of a game looks at it and goes, this doesn't sit right with me anymore.
Yeah.
And even though I don't have to, I'm going to change it because I think it reflects poorly on me.
Right.
Like, I'm trying to think of an example for my own stuff, and I kind of can't. Not that I have a $13 million Kickstarter. Not that I'm in any kind of league.
Okay, 12. 12?
12.5. Yeah, that was up there. But yeah. But I guess what else you said about raising the price, it does raise the price. And there's constant discussions about price in TTRPGs. And I think it unfortunately does leave some people out.
Right.
Because there were a couple, like when we were talking on Twitter about, like hiring editors or doing art or doing lead or stuff like that, a couple people, just kind of in their own little space said, well, that leaves me out, because the only kind of like the only thing I can do is write, and I'm not in a financial position to hire all these people to help my stuff. And I'm trying to think of a good, apart from raising the price of everything, and getting customers to expect that this is kind of now the new normal.
Right.
Which hopefully would have the effect of employing other people, which then feed money back into the hobby so that more games get made. I mean, someone has to kind of start the ball rolling. And unfortunately, just hiring a cultural sensitivity reader is another expense.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's true. That's interesting. Like, so it seems like a platform could solve that. Like itch.io could basically say, okay, we're kind of curating. Like, if you want a some status, like approved by us or whatever, it's going to have to go through kind of our bit of approval process. We're going to like read it for cultural sensitivity, just something. Mm. Just the same way that they, before they put a game like on an app store or whatever, they test to make sure it actually runs and it doesn't have, spyware in it or malware in it. That could be something. I mean, that becomes a little bit too much of a walled garden, and then like certain political views will be reinforced by a platform. Mm. You probably don't want that. But for somebody that would want that service, it would seem like if a platform had the ability to get to provide that to then take the expense.
Out of it,
because then they could say, okay, well, you let us have a say in the content of your game, like words you used or different terminology. So we'll elevate it in kind of the promotion or whatever. I don't know.
But you could do like itch funding, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I've seen people do it for like art and layout, like like all you're getting is a text version, or here's the artless version. If enough people buy, or like I've set this goal, this is how much it's going to cost me for art. So you could do it that way, where it's like, I need to hire a cultural sensitivity reader. This is how much it's going to cost me.
Read the insensitive version.
Yeah, read the insensitive version.
See how many mistakes I
have. I think it's kind of like you do the best you can.
Yeah.
But everyone has those biases and stuff that you're not going to see. You're like, oh, you know what? You're right. Kind of like that example I brought up before.
Oh,
like,
right.
Way back in the day when I like had that little idea for a set matching game that was aliens collecting people based on hair color.
Right.
Like shirt color and pants color. Right. And then I said, you know what? I want to kind of not center white people. So let's make all the characters non-white. And then it was like, oh, fine, that's a bad idea, right? I have now made a set collection game that it looks like you're collecting people based on. No, yeah. No, right? So, but it was like a day or two before I made that. So I totally understand why, even if you're trying to do your best, stuff's going to slip past you.
Right, right.
That's why editors and cultural sensitivity readers kind of exist to go, you probably didn't mean it, but take a look at this. And you're like, oh, fuck.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah, and so Childress also wanted to stress in the statement that the mechanics of the game remain identical. There isn't anything that they found in how the game plays. So you're going to get that same, as an expansion, you're going to get that same feel as original Gloomhaven. And finish the statement by saying, I want to thank all the people who have helped me realize my mistakes in the intervening years between the two projects. We all make mistakes, and the important thing is to learn from them and do our best to reverse any harm that those mistakes may have caused. There's more work to do in that regard, but I think making sure Frosthaven doesn't repeat those mistakes and talking to people about the process openly are the first good steps.
Yep.
And I think that's,
I agree.
The thing that I respect about this designer is everything is out front. Like talking about the whole production process and how everything, because this is a monstrous game and this could have failed, like logistically.
Right.
It's too heavy. It's, you know, the box is falling apart. We can't get all the cards in any reasonable size of box. I mean, the logistics of actually producing this as a product could have just, several people have failed in just that respect on Kickstarter with crowdfunding. And he's always been very open to the whole production process. And so then letting you in on the, you know, world building and trying to fix, in, you know, his opinion, get it fixed, get it perfected, right, get it, you know, improved, is great. It's great to see that. And I wish, all designers kind of had that approach to projects that they were doing instead of it becomes mysterious and all the money's gone and I'll cancel. So, yes, I really, I recommend stuff he works on just from that aspect of how their projects are produced.
Thinking of my own design process. A couple of people have said, oh, yeah, I really like how this works. And I'm like, that's great, because I just kind of fucking threw it together and found out, oh, it works.
It works. You know? Awesome.
So much as I want to give like a design process, I'm like, half the time I'm just like, I'm just making shit up as I go along. And it worked. So
Thank you, customer/playtester.
Yeah. You think I playtest my shit?
Yeah. All right. Yes. So that's good. So we are going to
Speaking of playtest.
Yeah, speaking of playtest, yeah, that's right. We're going to playtest a 21-year-old rule set.
Not that old.
Yeah, it is. It's 2000.
Okay, the update. I'm thinking of Warmaster Revolution.
Yes.
Yeah, so like 2019, I think. Right.
Mm-hmm. So I think we mentioned it last week. So Warmaster, so I kind of discovered in kind of lockdown hysteria fan project that's been turned into a fan produced second edition of Warmaster. So Warmaster was the Rick Priestley 10mm strategy Warhammer fantasy, old world fantasy, strategic army game. Yeah.
And they also dwarves are there.
Yes. And they also released an ancient, like, okay, so you can play historical kind of ancient battles. So, you know, Greek and all kinds of early Roman, Empire battles and everything. So a lot of people, so this system kind of still exists, and Rick Priestley took it to Warlord Games and is producing like Black Powder and a lot of the other kind of different era Bronze Age and different era games using this very similar system where there's a commander, you know, giving orders to units, and it becomes unreliable distances and things continue. So yeah, so I found that, and then I found the whole world of artists that are digital artists, sculptors that are producing miniatures for it. So there already exists, mostly in England, a lot of studios that produce metal miniatures and I think resin as well, of that tiny, for historical, Napoleonic, and now fantasy, a tiny, 10 to 15 millimeter, the kind of the range of those. But I found a couple of really amazing sets of these armies. The rules, the second edition rules, of course, are for free because, you know, it's a fan printer.
They're a mess. Yeah, they're like, I say that. Okay. I blame Rick Priestley. I've been spoiled on recent games. Reading this now, I'm just like,
yes.
Could you be any more convoluted and editorialize in the rules? Just, Someone needs to go through that thing and clean it the fuck up. So it's like presented in a logical goddamn order. Right. Looking at that, I'm like, how the fuck did I ever play Warhammer 2nd Edition back in the 90s if this is the level of writing? Like, oh, I learned from the other people who are already playing it. Right. There's no way in hell you could learn how to play from reading those rules.
Oh, that's a good point. And it is a very different aesthetic. And even they were even talking about that, like with early Dungeons and Dragons, like some of the modules, it's just like there is so much color commentary. And like, you know, and I smoke a cigarette. If you like to smoke cigarettes.
Yeah, exactly. That's what the rules read like. I'm like, oh, my God. Like, I'm bashing on a free product that I'm very excited to play.
Yes. Yeah. I'm really. Yeah,
but.
Yeah.
That thing needs to be cleaned up.
Right, right. And I think that this comes from, like, people discovered this game during lockdown because of the success of the Total War, Warhammer PC games. So that really, in a digital world, kind of recreates the massive battle kind of ranked troops aesthetic very well. But you don't have to physically move anything. It's kind of real time. So you just kind of put them into motion. And, People discovered the old world from that, maybe went to Games Workshop and said, oh, I guess they don't do that
anymore. Oh, I can't play with them anymore? Yeah.
And so this is like scratching that itch to actually, like, if you can meet in person, you know. And so I think people are building armies still in quarantine. They were building armies to, like, you know, then when they can finally meet each other. But there's a active Facebook group a lot of people that are, really into this game. So we really wanted to try this because this is a taste of 2000 gaming.
Also, like, it's an old taste of gaming. Also, as blah, blah, I promise I can talk, much like the appeal of Frostgrave, like you said, like a 2000 point army would fit in a goddamn shoebox.
Right.
And for people like us in Japan, where space is at a premium higher than gold or GW figures themselves, right? Right, having like a full army that just fits in a really small space is appealing. And maybe that's also why appealing, where like you have a 60 by 40 millimeter block of troops that represents like hundreds of figures. So it's kind of like, in addition to it feeling bigger than it is, but taking up a small amount of space, you're also playing with like hundreds or thousands of troops in this small space, which also is also kind of appealing.
Yeah. That cover illustration of the original Warmaster rulebook like really spoke to what they're trying to do, because it was just these cascading slopes of just infinite troops, you know, clashing in the valley, like between two mountains, and then the commanders not fighting. So it's like that's what they're trying to do, like in a reasonable way, because you know they have things like the super large scale 40K Armageddon, you know, style games and stuff. Is like, that's so much just to set up. How do you even, you know, And the cost of like, you know, 10,000 points of 40K.
Who wants to do that? My God.
Yeah. So this was nice. And this is, you know, finally, it's kind of the beginning of that, you know, it's a taste of the future. Like, what are we going to see? Like, we're going to be playing an old rule set with new minis that, you know, you are paying the artist directly for. That's amazing. Yeah. Because
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And it makes, and I like the, you know, cause the second edition, this fan edition of Warmaster is basically miniature agnostic. I mean, the old miniatures do exist, but there are several companies that are producing generic fantasy troops that can be used. And then all the artists that are giving you the STL files for 3D printing. Yeah. So.
And those miniatures look amazing.
Yeah. And it's amazing the detail. 10 millimeter. I already had so much trouble with 28 painting anything. And it's like, oh, let me go down like to 33% of that. So it's
crazy.
Well,
that's when you're just like, oops. That's when you're just like, blob, 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 contrast paint, wash, done. It looks amazing, yeah? Which is me. I realize that could come out the wrong way. I am not maligning your painting skills. No. I'm saying how easy it is and satisfying to just like have these massive armies that took you not that long to paint.
Right. Yeah, it's amazing. You can, in a day, you can have 1,000, 1,000 points of an army can come out of your printer. That's insane.
Well,
yeah,
they can if you have a printer.
Right.
You should have seen my partner's face when I said, yeah, Jeremy has a 3D printer. She went,
yes.
Did I mention I'm thinking of getting one? So would never be able to put it anywhere.
Right. A toddler covered in photosensitive resin.
The number of times I have to tell my kid, don't pull on the dishwasher door. Like, I can just see that thing just like, like, oh my God.
Yeah.
Did I mention that was like 3 months rent? Can we live in it? No. All right. Yeah.
And it doesn't actually make any money either.
No, it doesn't. It eats money.
All right. Yeah. So we will be doing that soon. So Where can people find you?
On Twitter, as always, where I was talking about tonight's game. And that's HiveMind, HYVEMYND. And there will be either an excited burst of tweets about how awesome the game is, or a massive screed about how much these rules suck, depending on how the game tonight goes.
So place your bets.
I'm planning for it to be fun. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm breaking a rule. Oh. So we're going to be playing mostly unpainted.
Oh, that's fine.
Yeah. So, fine. It's probably not going to be well documented. And this is going to be kind of an off camera, like learn the rules. So if we want to actually film something, we're not going to look so incompetent.
Yeah. Or we could just chalk it up to Rick Priestley's in depth writing. Like,
Priestley.
Wow. All right. Hopefully he doesn't listen to this. Why would he?
I think that the rules we're actually looking at are actually like a refinement, like everything from what was released. Because, you know, it had like 9 years of updates and refining for the ancient battle system and everything. So, yeah. So we'll see. We'll see how this goes.
I'm excited.
All right. So thank you for joining us, and give us a like if you enjoyed watching this. And you can subscribe to the audio podcast version of this if you go to upturnedtable.com.
Become a weakling.
Yes. And yes, on patreon.com/upturnedtable, you can be a weakling and help support this weekly podcast and give us some feedback about what you would like to see as far as weekly
War Master Revolution games.
Yes. That should be the top priority. So, and also you can find us upturntable.com and then both on Twitter and Instagram. Yeah. Although, there will be some 10mm painted minis on Instagram soon. And thank you for joining us. We'll be back next week.
Later, mortals.
Goodbye.